today we're going to look at the colonial Jewish, American Jewish community and discuss what these pioneers of American Jewish life can teach us about Jewish life across North America today. So here's a little background to the colonial era. Jewish history in America is dated by historians to September 1654 with the arrival of 23 Jews from Recife, Brazil. Now, those Jews had been living in Recife, which was a Dutch colony, for decades until Portugal took over the area. When Portugal took control, they brought back the Inquisition, which was a problem for those Jews, especially because many of them had been former Muranos, who once they were in the Dutch colony said, guess what, really Jewish. So if the Inquisition's back, guess who's number one on the most wanted list? So all of the Jews of Recife, Brazil, hightailed it out of there. The vast majority went back to Amsterdam. But 23 of them decided to go instead to the next closest Dutch colony, which was a small outpost known as New Amsterdam, which would later become known as New York. Right. So how do we know that they arrived? For one, there are records of services held on that Rosh Hashanah, which was 10 days later. Two, we know they arrived because within a few days of arriving, they were suing each other in court. So there was that friction from day one. Now, why do historians consider them the first Jewish community? They're actually not the first Jews in America. There were a number of Jewish men, mostly single merchants, who passed through the Jewish community before these 23. So one reason they're considered a community is because they got official permission to stay. When they arrived, Peter Stuyvesant, who was the governor of the province, tried to get them kicked out. You know, because we let Jews in. There goes the neighborhood. Okay, but they then wrote appeal to the Dutch West Indies Company for official permission to stay, being backed by the Jews of Amsterdam, and they got that. They got that permission to stay. In great part because the Dutch West Indies Company acknowledged that their goal is to build the economy. And guess what? Jews are good for the economy. So their permission to stay. The second reason they're considered the first Jewish community is because the previous people who had come were men, you know, merchants, businessmen who came in, stayed there for a little bit, passed through. But men can't make a community. When the 23 Jews came from Recife, Brazil, that was a mixture of men, women, and children. And when you have men, women, and children, when you have that family unit, that's when you have a community. By the time the United States was born in 1776, that community of 23 had grown to 2,000. Just as a basis of comparison, the population of the Jews in 1654 was around 1 million, and about 2 million in 1776. The vast, vast, vast majority of Jews at that time were living either in the Polish-Lithuanian Empire or in the Ottoman Empire. What was happening in Canada at the time? For Jews, not much. In 1663, Louis XIV of France had declared that only Roman Catholics were allowed to settle in Canada, which was then a French province. The Seven Years' War brought Jews to Canada who were fighting for the British, and when the British won, they stayed. The first official recorded Jewish resident of Canada was a man named Samuel Jacobs, and that was in 1759. But he really wasn't the first Jew to live in Canada. And this is a fantastic story. In 1738, a 20-year-old young woman named Esther Brandau, for reasons unknown, masqueraded as a boy, became a sailor, and went to Canada with the Navy. Once she arrived, her gender and her religion were discovered, and she was arrested. The government hoped that they could convince her to convert to Catholicism. But after a year of living in Canada and refusing to convert, because she said, I want to live in Canada as a Jew, she was actually deported back to France. So Canada's Jewish community really didn't explode in size until the late 1800s. Today, the two major Jewish centers of the world are North America and Israel. But these population centers are of a very recent vintage. They're only a creation of the post-Holocaust world. So why do we care about colonial Jews? I mean, in terms of their significance to the Jewish world at the time, we may as well be talking about the Jews of Saskatchewan. But they are important, because studying colonial Jews, it's more than studying colonial Jews. Although numerically small, they're super interesting because they're facing so many of the same issues that we encounter today. So that couple of thousand Jews living in America, they were unique and they were colorful. And by examining their lives, their connections to Judaism, their values, we can learn a lot about ourselves as North American Jews and about the community today. So I want to start with a little art analysis. We don't have, I wanted it on the projector, and we don't have that, but let's see if we can make do. Can you all see this picture? Yeah. Sort of, a little? This painting is called Martha Levy at the Spinet. It was painted by a renowned portrait artist named Thomas Scully in 1810. Looking at this picture, for those of you who are seeing it, what can you tell me? What can you tell me about Martha Levy? What can you guess about Martha Levy? She is wealthy, okay? She's wealthy. How do you know she's wealthy? Okay, right? She has time to play the piano. She's learning an instrument that's associated with the higher class, okay? There's also a book on the piano, which implies that she is literate, okay? Which is also something interesting for women of that generation. You know, if you're literate, okay, so obviously you had an education, there's some level of wealth. And she's very well-dressed. She's wearing a beautiful gown. What do you think that this painting can tell us about Jewish life in America in the early 19th century? What? That what?
No, I just said pretty good.
Right, things are pretty good. Jews seem successful, wealthy, educated. There's nothing really particularly Jewish about the photo. It gives the message that Jews very much wanted to fit in, you know, learning to play the spinet, that's a very upper class activity. They wanted to fit in. I want to tell you now a little bit of a backstory. Martha Levy was not Jewish. Her father was Judge Moses Levy, a Jew from a well-respected colonial Jewish family. Her mother was Mary Pierce Levy, an Episcopalian Methodist Christian. Martha was raised as a Methodist, and she left no Jewish descendants. So why is this painting so important to our understanding of colonial Jews if she's not Jewish? Okay, it shows us the degree to which Jews wanted to fit in, and also kind of makes us wonder, well, is she typical? What was our rate of intermarriage? So Martha Levy actually was very typical. The rate of intermarriage was high as 25%. Now, in our days of the Pew study and intermarriage rates of 50% or higher, 25% might seem, hey, that's not so bad. But at that same time period, the intermarriage rate in the rest of the Jewish world was less than 1%. So the intermarriage rate in this community is astronomical. 25% is astronomical. If we go back to our friend Samuel Jacobs, our first Canadian Jew, he also intermarried and raised his children Christian. So why is the rate of intermarriage so?
What community did she live in? What city did she live in?
Martha Levy?
Yes.
New York. So why is the rate of intermarriage so high in colonial Jews when it's so low elsewhere? So let's take a step back now and think about the situation in America for Jews who had immigrated during the colonial period. So first, they're not necessarily religious. It's a self-selecting population. There is no Jewish infrastructure in America at this time. There's no major Jewish organizations. There's no yeshivot. There are no real prominent rabbis. Historians found a letter from 1784, a petition to build a mikvah in Philadelphia. You're talking about Philadelphia. That was a large established community. And in 1784, there was no mikvah. There was also no Jewish time, and that's something that we'll talk about in a later letter. Do you know what I mean when I say Jewish time? When you were living in a Jewish community in Europe, you are living within Jewish time. What day is it? It's Erev Shabbat. It's Motzei Shabbat. What time is it now? It's after Shachrit. Okay, later it's going to be between Mincha and Maariv. What time of year is it? It's between Purim and Pesach. They lived in Jewish time. Their worldview was Jewish. You're coming to America, you're not living in Jewish time anymore. There's no concept of the Jewish holidays are coming. You know, a little bit you can feel it in Israel. Right? If you're ever in Israel in the month before Hanukkah, and you'll see all the public buses say Hanukkah Sameach, you know, you feel like a little bit the sense of Jewish time. You don't feel it elsewhere in the world, and you certainly didn't feel it in colonial America. There's also, again, no rabbinic authority. There's really not much religious authority at all in America, especially in the Wild West. In America, Judaism was voluntary. You could choose whether to practice or not to practice, how much to practice, how to practice. Okay, that's very different from Europe, where the Jewish leadership had a lot of power and community leaders could mandate observance. In Europe, if somebody didn't want to observe Judaism, so there'd be a great intellectual defense of why am I making this choice? You don't have that in America. There's no concept of Haskalah or at this point of kind of religious reform. You don't want to practice, just don't do it. No one cares, no one's watching you, no one's stopping you. So that's America. America is about consent, not dissent, right? America doesn't care about lineage and heritage. Britain, right, you think about Britain, all they cared about was dissent, as anyone who's watched Downton Abbey knows very well, right? Your place in society is determined by your birth. America is about choosing your identity, the self-made man. And that kind of ethos isn't conducive to heritage, including religious heritage. And certainly no one cares if you have yichus, if you have religious, prestigious lineage. People were interested in making money. That's why they're coming over to America. And you had to have kind of the adventurous or risk-taking personality to go to what was, you know, a new growing world. So with this list of qualities, we might wonder how there's any Jewish community in America at the time at all. Did they care about being Jewish? So I'm going to look at another source now. I'm going to read this to you. This is a letter written by a German immigrant. Germany didn't really exist, but from the area of Europe that would become Germany. And she's writing a letter back to her parents who were still living in Hamburg in the 1790s. Dear parents, I hope my letter will ease your mind. You can now be reassured and send me one of the family to Charleston, South Carolina. She's currently writing from Petersburg, Virginia. This is the place to which, with God's help, we will go after Passover. The whole reason why we are leaving this place is because its lack of Yehudishkeit, Judaism. Dear parents, I know quite well you will not want me to bring up my children like Gentiles. Here, they cannot become anything else. Jewishness is pushed aside. There are here in Petersburg, Virginia, 10 or 12 Jews, and they are not worthy of being called Jews. We have a shochet here who goes to market and buys treif meat and then brings it home. On Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the people worshipped here without one sefer Torah, and not one of them wore a talit or the arba kanfot, except Hyman, that's her husband, and my Sammy's godfather. The latter is an old man of 60, a man from Holland. He's been in America for 30 years already. For 20 years, he was in Charleston, and he's been living here for 4 years. He does not want to remain here any longer and will go with us to Charleston. In that place, there's a blessed community of 300 Jews. You can believe me that I crave to see a synagogue to which I can go. The way we live now, it's no life at all. We do not know what the Sabbath and the holidays are. On the Sabbath, all the Jewish shops are open, and they do business on that day as they do throughout the whole week. But ours, we do not allow to open. With us, there is still some Sabbath. You must believe me that in our house, we all live as Jews as much as we can. As for the Gentiles, we have nothing to complain about. For the sake of a livelihood, we do not have to live here. Nor do we have to leave because of debts. I believe ever since Hyman has grown up, he has not had it so good. You cannot know what a wonderful country this is for the common man. One can live here peacefully. Hyman made a clock that goes very accurately. Now you can imagine what honors he has been getting here. In all Virginia, there's no clock like this one, and Virginia is the greatest province in the whole of America, and America is the largest section of the world. Now you know what sort of country it is. It's not too long since Virginia was discovered. It is a young country, and it is amazing to see the business they do in this little Petersburg. At times, as many as 1,000 hogsheads of tobacco arrive at one time, and each contains 1,000, sometimes 1,200 pounds of tobacco. It's shipped from here to the whole world. When my brother Judah comes here, he can become a watchmaker and a goldsmith if he so desires. Here it's not like Germany, where a watchmaker is not permitted to sell silverware. They don't know otherwise here. They expect a watchmaker to be a silversmith. The work is well paid, but in Charleston, it pays even better. All the people who hear we are leaving give us their blessing. They say that it is sinful that such blessed children should be brought up here in Petersburg. My children cannot learn anything here, nothing Jewish, nothing of general culture. My Shone, it's her daughter, is already 3 years old. I think it's time she should learn something, and she has a good head to learn. And my Sammy, God bless him, is already beginning to talk. I could write more. However, I do not have any more paper. I remain your devoted daughter and servant, Rebecca, the wife of Chaim, the son of Samuel the Levite. It's 1790. It's an amazing letter. It's really an amazing letter. How does she feel about America? Does she like it?
Yes,
she loves America. America's great. Does she want to leave? Nope. Definitely not. They've never had it so good. But she acknowledges the difficulties with Jewish life. How is she going to manage to raise Jewishly committed children in an environment that has no Jewishness? So she recognizes she's living in an area that's Jewishly desolate. And therefore, she finds a better one. She's going to move to a Jewish community that has a stronger Jewish environment. So if you combine Martha Levy and Rebecca Samuels, what do we know? So they love the surrounding Christian world's acceptance of Jews. But they're not sure how to continue to live a Jewish religious life here. How do we balance being involved participants in American culture and society with being committed Jews? Good? It's okay. And I want to just take a moment just to acknowledge the professional benefits here. I don't know if you can follow her back and forth about the difference between Germany, but in Germany you had all these guilds and there's all these regulations. Can you belong to this guild and that guild, and Jews are excluded from this and Jews are excluded from that. You come to America, you can do anything. You can do anything and you can be successful and you can make money. Okay, so next I want to look to explore this further. Look at another colonial woman. And her name is Abigail Levy Franks. This is a picture of her, and this is a portrait of her, of two of her children. I'll pass this one around. We can start on this side. Okay, while you're passing that around, I'll give you a little bit of background. So Abigail Levy Franks was a doyenne of colonial New York society and a Jew. The children on the right are her children, David and Rika, probably Rivka. They are, in fact, related to Martha Levy, the girl at the spinet, and these portraits were painted in 1735. So Abigail Levy Franks was born in London in 1696 to a prominent Jewish family. She and her family settled in the American colonies in 1703. She marries Jacob Franks, a wealthy Jewish merchant, and she died in 1756 in New York. So what do these pictures tell us about Abigail and her family? They're not dissimilar to Martha Levy. They are also dressed in very fashionable clothing. They, and for the ones who've seen it, you want to comment anything on the pictures?
Better.
She is Jewish. Why are you questioning it? Well, I know she wasn't. No, Abigail Levy Franks was Jewish. She's not necessarily dressed the way you might expect a traditional, right. She's not dressed what we would consider traditionally modest. She's dressed very much in what would have been the fashion at the time. The children are also beautifully dressed. The portraits are meant to be hung together. You see her fashionable clothing. You see that her hands are very genteel. They don't look like hands that are used to hard work. And the importance of women's hands in that generation, that was a very big thing, what women's hands look like. Behind her is this pastoral scene, which again was very trendy for the times. She lived in New York. I don't think that was really her backdrop. Okay. And what's also interesting is that there's nothing Jewish about either painting at all. You don't see a sitter in the background, anything, any kind of symbol, nothing that would indicate in the pictures that she was Jewish. But the portraits are far from what we know about Abigail Levy Franks. She was a prolific letter writer, and her letters are still, they exist. We have her letters. Her correspondence is one of the richest we have of any woman in the colonial era, Jew or non-Jew. So historians know so much about her because of her correspondence, mainly with her son Naftali, who was living in London. Naftali was her oldest child, and he went to London to work for his uncle and seek his fortune as a young adult. She sent two sons to London in hopes that they would succeed financially with in the family business and that they would marry Jewish. Abigail loved Naftali dearly and missed him all the days of her life. So Abigail Levy Franks, along with her husband, they were pillars of the New York Jewish community, and they had very high social standing in non-Jewish society. She was a welcome visitor at the governor's mansion. She was a member of high society. She also lived an observant Jewish life. Her husband was a trustee of She'erith Israel, the first congregation in America. Her children attended She'erith Israel school. Abigail kept a kosher home. She observed Shabbat and holidays. She believed in God. She believed in Judaism. She instructed Naftali, who was living with her brother in London, to pray every morning, to daven, and not to eat anything but bread and butter in her brother's home because she did not trust his kashrut. But despite her strong connection to Jewish heritage, Franks writes very little about Judaism in her letters. She writes about the literature she reads, she reports on the political goings-on, she reports about the social goings-on in New York City, all the latest gossip in great detail. There's no description of Shabbat, there's no description of holiday meals, of synagogue services, or of any other ritual practice. When she does mention the Jewish community of New York, she expresses disdain. She wrote about how she doesn't socialize with any of the other Jewish women in New York, saying, quote, "I don't often see any of our ladies but at synagogue, for they are a stupid set of people." But mum for that. So she was invested in American society. She's invested in culture. She's invested in politics. She did not see herself as living a separate existence from her Gentile neighbors. She is well-educated. She's an Enlightenment thinker. Her Judaism seems almost taken for granted. She observes, but she doesn't really think too much about it. And that's what makes the letter that I'm going to read to you next so fascinating. The most fascinating thing is the event that tortured her most in her life. In September of 1742, Phila Franks, her beloved daughter, intermarried. Now, in the end, of her three children who remained in the United States, two intermarried and one never married. Now, Phila married a man whose name might be familiar to you, Oliver Delancey. That's Delancey of Delancey Street fame. He was a Christian, but as a Delancey, he is a real member of high society. And Abigail, this woman who never really wrote about Judaism, never really expressed her feelings about heritage, was devastated when Phila married a non-Jew. So she writes this letter to her son in London. So first I want to point out the letter, she has a house in town, that's New York, but she also has her, you know, vacation outside of home. So that's in Flatbush, because that's out in, you know, the farmlands. Okay, so she starts by wishing him joy on hearing that his new wife, who she has never met, is expecting a baby. And there's something a little bit hard here. I shall think the time tedious until I shall have the happy information, you know, what they had. For I don't expect to hear it by return of these ships, and therefore must enjoy your care in writing by the first opportunity. So she knows that she might not find out. She's not going to find out that she was a grandmother for months after that baby is born. And that's a hard reality, you think about it. You know, a lot of people are living away from their children, away from their parents, but we have so many ways of connecting. She's never going to see these children, and they're across the world, and she's relying on letters that are arriving months after they're written. Okay, so after that, she continues. I am now retired from town and would from myself, if it were possible to have some peace of mind, from the severe affliction I am under on the conduct of that unhappy girl. Good God, what a shock it was when they acquainted me she had left the house and had been married 6 months. So she had been secretly married for 6 months before she left, and living at home before she left her house and moved in with her husband. I can hardly hold my pen whilst I am writing it. It was what I never could have imagined, especially after what I heard her so often to say, that no consideration in life should ever induce her to disoblige such good parents. I have heard reports of her going to be married to Oliver Delancey, but as such reports had often been of either of your sisters, I gave no heed of it further than a general caution of her conduct, which has always been unblemished, and is so still in the eyes of the Christians, who allow she has disobliged us, but has in no way been dishonorable, being married to a man of worth and character. So you understand, she's mad that she intermarried, but she acknowledges, I mean, she got married, she didn't run away with him, I mean, she married him, he is in high social standing. My spirits were for some time so depressed, it was a pain for me to speak to or see anyone. I've overcome it so far as not to make my concern so conspicuous, but I shall never have that serenity nor peace within I have so happily had before. My house has been my prison. Ever since, I've not heart enough to go near the street door. It's pain to me to think of going again to town. I wish it were in my power to leave this part of the world. She goes on to say that Oliver is trying to broker a reconciliation, and she's doesn't want to meet, she wouldn't go meet with him, but now he's saying he's going to come visit her, and she doesn't know what to do because she knows she can't like really be rude to him. So, you know, I'll be civil to him, but that's it, right? As for his wife, I am determined I will never see her, nor let none of you, your family, go near her. Can you imagine? She says she will never see or speak to her daughter again. And she follows through on that. And then she does go on to say, he intends to write to you and my brother Isaac to endeavor a reconciliation. I would have you answer his letter, if you don't hers, for I must be so ingenuous to confess, nature is very strong, and it would give me a great concern if she should live unhappy, though it's a concern she does not merit. So she wants the best for her daughter, right? But she's not going to see her again. So why does Phila intermarry? Why do you think she intermarried?
Maybe there weren't any other good choices.
Okay, so possibly, right, there's no one Jewish who's her social equal. Certain greenhorns, right, new immigrants, well, that's certainly not going to work. And you see the way her mother refers to the Jews of New York. They seem to not be on their social strata. Historians have pointed out that it's almost startling to read her passionate reaction to Phila's intermarriage, given the total lack of attention to anything Jewish in any of her letters. Historians find her reaction excessive. Perhaps even more excessive when we understand that after her marriage, Phila was dead to her. She never saw her. She never spoke to her. So scholars might have a hard time. Yes? Yes, I mean, certainly although people did mention that Oliver Delancey got married recently to a Jew, you know, and kind of was like, to a Jew. You know, that was like a little bit, you know, it was worth mentioning. It was worth mentioning that she was a Jew, but it did seem in his eyes not to matter. I think scholars have a hard time understanding it, but Abigail's reaction, but I think it is clear to us. I think that we do understand her sorrow. She didn't succeed in transmitting Judaism. She thought that her daughter would naturally inherit her beliefs, but she didn't. And one scholar of Abigail Levy Frank's, Edith Gellis, explains it like this. Abigail took religion for granted, like nature, and Phila had transgressed against nature. So confident was she about her own Jewish identity, enough so that she felt free to criticize the religion and the people, that she was stunned to discover that her children did not experience the same fundamental loyalty to their lineage. So what do we see about colonial Jews from the three images, from Martha Levy at the Spinet, from Rebecca Samuels, from the portraits? Yeah. That's right. They right. And they succeeded. Married. Not right, but not marry them. Right? That they wanted to blend in. And the community was very happy to have them join. Yeah, do you want to add something? Right. They're willing to sacrifice it. It certainly trumped it. It certainly trumped it for them. And I'm not sure that was a conscious decision. You know, I don't know that Abigail Levy Franks ever sat and decided, this is more important to me. It was more that what she emphasized and what she didn't emphasize. Like, I mean, I don't think it was a conscious decision, but in reality, that is what they did. So they struggled a lot to square their Judaism with a very non-Jewish and a very welcoming world around them. They didn't suffer much anti-Semitism or legal discrimination. They were, for the most part, accepted and loved and even married by their Christian neighbors. And they weren't very religious to begin with, because if they had, they probably never would have come to America to start. But their Judaism is still important to them, and they wanted to live Jewish lives. And they had trouble figuring out, where do we draw the line between fitting into a society where they lived and separating themselves from that society. They worried about how to transmit their feelings about being Jewish to their children, and they despaired when they felt they failed at that task. And in the end, that's why studying colonial Jews is so incredibly compelling, because in the end, they are so much like us. We also live in a society. It's kind to us. It's welcoming to us. We also struggle. The whole modern orthodoxy, the challenge of modern orthodoxy is the struggle of how much to fit into America, to general society in America, in Canada, and how much to differentiate ourselves as Jews. And we too wonder whether we have accurately and effectively transmitted our Jewish values to our children. And that's the magic of studying history, because sometimes you look back into the past and you're surprised to see in many ways yourself, your community reflected back. And it's a wonderful opportunity to learn from those who came before us and to understand ourselves better through their eyes. Rebecca Samuels, Abigail Levy Franks, they're dealing in colonial times with the same fundamental question we deal with today. How do we create a community, a next generation, that cares about Judaism? How do we take part in the best that the secular world has to offer while keeping distance from what's negative? And like in colonial times, it's a legitimate challenge. And that's what is so great about studying history. We can see ourselves in the Jews of the past, we can learn from their mistakes, from their triumphs, and with Hashem's help, raise a happy, successful, Jewishly committed next generation and create a healthy Jewish community for tomorrow. Thank you. Questions? Yes. Oh my, okay, in the back. That what? No, I think that you're right. I don't mean to say that we have learned from our past, but that we can learn from the past. I think we should learn from our past. Yeah, I think that's one of the tragedies globally in the world is just the reluctance to take an honest look at the past and see what the messages are for today. Yes. Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think when I say historians, I mean those that really aren't well-versed in the community, that don't know the community from the emotional perspective. If you just look at the sources, you have a woman who never wrote anything positive about the Jewish community. And you have a woman who doesn't write about her observance, doesn't write positive things about the community, makes fun of the other people in the community, and then's horrified when her daughter doesn't marry one of them. Who'd you want her to marry? You probably nixed every potential Jewish guy out there. Yes?
I don't know. But were these people looking for acceptance in the Christian community, or were they looking for the good things that maybe the community had to
offer? I think it's both. I don't think that was separated. I think part of the good it had to offer was being an accepted part of the community. I think they're socialites. You know, think about the time period we're talking about. They're socialites. And if you're a socialite, then you want to be at the top of the social strata. And then obviously even for the, you know, Rebecca Samuels isn't a socialite, right? She's on the poorer end. They want to be financially stable. They want to do well, start a big business, to enjoy all of the economic opportunities that are available to them here and are totally not available in Europe. No, I haven't. But that's the question: is who did they? What were you going to say? I was going to. Who are they going to? Who are they going to? Well, no, you're talking about the Brit. They could marry with the Brit. So then the question. So I haven't. But I would ask. I would think a couple of questions. Would they have married Jews? Was it from the Jews that were stronger on not intermarrying, or the English on not marrying Jews, or both? They would marry Jews. So that would be a really interesting thing to investigate. Maybe there was more of them. Maybe they had a little bit more of a social structure. I mean, America was the perfect storm because you had a Jewish community who didn't have a lot of options of who to marry. You know, Moses Levy's also intermarrying. There aren't a lot of available people. Okay, you think we have a shidduch crisis today? Okay, there was a shidduch crisis. There was no one to marry. Okay, and you have a population that's willing to marry Jews, and you have a self-selecting population that aren't the most Jewishly committed. So it really was a perfect storm. One more. I don't know how many much more time do we have?
4 minutes.
Okay.
I just want to point out the education system. The affluent were more prone to hire a tutor or a teacher. And I don't know, in this case, was it a Jewish teacher? Was it a non-Jewish teacher?
Okay, so She'erith Israel had a school. They had a school. It is nothing that resembles anything we would think of a school today. You know, it's a very rudimentary Jewish education. And then, yeah, the upper class is, it's the same what you would imagine in Europe, or if you heard me talk about, Beis Yaakov yesterday, of the kind of education the wealthy girls in the 1800s were getting in Poland. Yeah, they would get that same tutored, you know, the more classical education. With who? The Franks would, because they're wealthy. They'd have the tutors. Franks, so it's interesting. So we know that Abigail Levy Frank's children go to the She'erith Israel school. When she talks about her kids, she's going to teach them. Who's teaching them in Petersburg, Virginia? If her kids are going to learn anything, it's because she's going to teach them, because there isn't a Melamed. You know, there isn't a Malamed there, and there isn't a school for them to go to, so she'll teach them, which means, you know, they're not learning to analyze a Rashi. None of these women are learning. None of these kids are learning how to analyze a Rashi. Yes? I'm sorry, one... So, as a general rule, girls were given the same education as boys up until a point. So they would learn literacy Yiddish. They learn how to read Hebrew, how to read from a sitter. When it got to the point of, let's say, learning Chumash or learning Talmud, so then the girls were at that point done. That was a general rule. Although the Sheir Israel School, I don't think had that advanced of a curriculum for anyone. It was both ways. It really was both ways. And there were also going to be more men than women because you have more men coming to, like, try their fortune and find their fortune. Any other questions? Okay, thank you all for coming.